Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about podcasts while driving. This time I'm going to try and cover some of the developments in the Einstein to Haas experiment. So to clue people in, the actual venue of this podcast is me driving home all the way from Katoomba. My son, who's working up in Katoomba, the train's failed, and so rather than hassle about it, I just got in the car about 6:45 and drove all the way up here, and he works in this really complicated place to get to. So this is on the return journey. I obviously wouldn't podcast with him in the car while I'm discussing things. And so that's the venue. You'll hear me going. It should take about, half an hour, something like that, to drive from Katoomba back down to Glenbrook. Probably an hour, I think, around that time. I just have a look about, probably 40 minutes, all in all. And the Einstein to Haas experiment, what's the story going on here? Well, I've decided, having read the literature, that there were some basic experiments that you could do, and looking at the sort of concept is out of the box. That is an experiment that you could develop that other people could reproduce and become a staple experimental gap. So if you have the idea that education's perfect. I'm trying not to get killed here, guys. Education is perfect, and everything's been done before. Just to pick up what's going on. Okay, I'm on the right way. I'm on the way home now. So there's having read through, I said, these obvious gaps. Gap experiments that really need to be built and researched and understood. And this Einstein to Haas experiment is a very simple one. It is that this car's is a tradie car, he's got no time, it's sort of really accelerating fast. It's going above the speed limit almost there already. Okay, I'm just getting on the road coming out from Lura. The Blue Mountains. So the idea is that you have a sample, and in the sample are electrons. And the electrons all behave as little spinning tops. Or do they? But they have the property of a spinning top, that when you flip them upside down, they twirl in the opposite direction. Therefore, if you get this to go in time to a pendulum, you can actually get your pendulum to swing. Clock. And so this is the Einstein to Haas pendulum. And there's two things I have to do. Is one is describe what I'm building. First off, it's a concept prototype. That's where it's a prototype which shows the concept. It is working, but I sort of didn't expect it to work right away. And the realization is a fairly simple ferrite. Now, initially I used a radio ferrite, and this is a reporting I've moved on and using these much more precision little bits of tube. They look like bits of macaroni, but they're precision. It's precision. It's beautifully polished. It's a beautiful piece of ferrite, very well dimensioned, and they're about a centimetre across and 15 centimetres, so 10 millimetres diameter and 15 millimetres length. And what I've done is, I've just simply super glued three of these together. So you sit them down in a groove provided by the aluminium extrusion construction software. It's metal extrusion. There's this metal extrusion with these slots in it, which is 40. You have to slow right down here. Okay. So I'm going through some sort of weird school zone high up in the mountains. So it's Blue Mountains Grammar, way up here at Wentworth Falls. You put these in a rack. They all sit together. You put a little magnet on one side so that magnetizes them all. So this is essentially iron oxide zinc sintered material, which is a highly magnetic pottery called ferrite. And you put these together, and three of them you just duck in a bit of super glue. Now, the reason that I use super glue is that super glue is an anaerobic adhesive. So if you've got two well surface mounting surfaces together, the adhesive will directly solidify and bind these together. And this is a rather satisfying thing to do. You can produce a fairly high quality device. Now, this is not ideal, because ideally you want it to all the way solid through, unless it's hollow in the center. And being hollow in the center, you can from there start to engineer a way of holding it. And I can report that I've looked at different ways of holding it, you know, twirling up a piece of paper tight enough and trying to thread the wire directly through the center of the coil. Very difficult to do. Tried it with a bit of aluminium foil there and produced a reasonably good advance. But the greatest advance, of course, is to have so I've been using, instead of cotton thread, nylon, single nylon thread. So this is much finer, with no fibers on the outside of it, so it doesn't grab or anything like that. That's a much better tolerance. And I'm using two of those, and I thread a loop through the hole and pull it across and pull the two threads away from each other. Thus, I'm just checking I'm doing the right thing, and thus the rod is suspended through these two strands, which are pulled apart from each other, left and right, if you'd like. And when it's pulled apart, I dab in a bit of hot melt glue to put them in position. And this position is relatively right. I'd say to within rotation. I've not got perfect rotation, but I'm getting very close. And the underneath, I've got the bearing of a fidget spinner. I don't know if you know these things from China. They're little ball bearings and weights on the outside. A ball bearing. A ball bearing race. And what I did was I was working with a fidget spinner and was trying to actually get it to go to very high speed with a high speed engine. I put that in a plastic container, and once I got it to go at high speed, it just fell completely apart. Now I used the components, so that was to give a model electron something which had inertia that you could feel, rotational inertia you could feel. Now that failed dismally. I had some interesting fun putting that together. And that failed dismally, fell right apart, and the little bits of the fidget spinner provided me with a bearing and mounts that I could use to mount the bottom hook of this. So this is a bipolar, a doubly suspended torsion pendulum, above and below suspended, double suspended torsion pendulum. So the entire thing is that this is now constrained from moving left and right, or up and down, or swaying, because it's suspended. Now, as you as you think you on this you the you want to constrain as much as possible, such as it's free to rotate, but only in the direction that you want. And there's a number of reasons for this, because as you excite this little thing, you can put forces through it. Now, ideally, you're putting this little pendulum in a oscillating magnetic field, and the magnetic field switches from north to south, switches directions north to south, and ideally the current is the same going forward as backwards. Now, electronics and measurement tells you that it is, but indeed it's never perfect. That's your switching reversing current, so there must be a slight twitch in it. There's also a slight switch when you switch it off, when the field switches off momentarily. And this is about 50 milliseconds. A 20th of a second as it clicks across. And you can do this, because if you hold the device in your hand, you don't feel anything with it, but you do feel this little tick as the pole field reverses. Now, in the goodness of time, it was the 8th, in a few weeks' time, I'll receive a little package from China, which is the solid-state version of the switch, which will allow me to switch in a tenth this time. It'll reduce this flicking effect time. But the idea is to build something so symmetrical, make everything so symmetrical, that any slight asymmetry in your drive is removed. So the idea of this fidget spinner rotation is that you can mount it, check it's perfect, and then wind it up. And as you've got these two parallel threads wound up, they cross over. As you wind it up, they will cross over above and below your cylinder, which is suspended, and your cylinder, it's got these two nylon threads going parallel through. I'm trying to explain as best as I can. And so I'm just a little bit off the getting that fidget spinner thing in, namely because my glue gun, which I'm building this with, has fused. It's charging thing has fused a little bit, and so I have to hold it down rather than I have to hold it in a position to heat up. So that's a bit of an effort for it. So I'm a short way away from it. Now, even so, I've installed this device. Now, much to my horror, is that I'm looking for an effect which is supposed to be, the bee's knees, the hardest effect that you can possibly achieve scientifically. And the challenges are there, but I know that I can meet each challenge. I know that I can demagnetize. So ideally, in the literature, it says that to build one of these, it has to be in a zero magnetic field area. Now, this may seem impossibly hard, but there's such a thing called as a, couldn't be called a Helmholtz coil. I don't remember what it is called, but there is a way of zeroing a field. And theoretically, zeroing fields was used to be in the preserve of universities, but it's no longer, because you can get a resistive three-axis magnetometer, which is exquisitely sensitive, and use statistics. And this is one thing I do have an advantage of, is signal analysis. That's something that I can do and I can pretty well zero the field in the region of the sample. So it's, that should be recent. But even at the moment, the little sample is oscillating like crazy in the center. It's beginning to behave a little bit more sedately and sanely now that I'm building a simple sample, but it's not nowhere near going to zero rotation. Got another school zone coming up around here. Cruising up around 40 kilometers an hour. So the point is that I'm building the concept. Concept prototype. And the main thing is that I've got a limited audience of friends, and so they're tolerant, as I say. I'm building it now. What I'm building really is a concept prototype. So across. So I'm beginning to write up the theory for it. Now, it is not a simple process of writing up the theory because this is directed, experiment is directed at a problem area of conception. The thesis is that education is a conceptual disarray and this is just not simply a blind, this is a deliberate foray into the realm of conceptual disarray. And it's a very deliberate review of concepts. And going into it, there's various things, like the entire way that maybe feels are taught at school is technically incorrect. It produces a set of consistent answers for students to learn, recite and reduce, but it's actually physically got no physical bearing on what they observe and understand. So that's okay. I'm just going to check that I'm recording at this point in time. Yeah, it looks like I am recording. Okay. Writing the research paper is quite a difficult thing because it's not a classic research paper where you simply you do minimum explanation. There's minimum context because context is of a normal research papers is that field is not in complete conceptual disarray, whereas this paper has got to address it. And I have the concept here of a education scenario steeped in Newtonian concepts. It has to suddenly start dealing with the concept of spin, and there's this sort of view, if you don't know about it, that spin, which is a hidden rotation, identified as a hidden rotation. Someone has written a paper about it, and I'm just trying to find it in the 30s about how spin can be, have an analogy of a spinning ball, but of course that's lost, but that's been captured. So what so often happens is that people who are not expert in the fields rifle through papers and pick up a paper which is convenient for them to pick it up, this strategy doesn't lead to a coherent examination. Now, one of the points I want to say is that the spin is very difficult for people to deal with. However, you can select different points along a continuum of development, and you can pick a point, say 75% of the way along the way to describe spin, but then you have your difficulty of explaining that there is this development along here. So spin is a property of an electron, where it has the property of an object which is spinning, a gyroscopic moment, but it has no other features of it. It has no electron. You can't put a marking on it and actually count the number of revolutions per second. That spin, we don't mean it's actually spinning, but it's got the property of it. It's also got the property of a magnetic field, but we don't believe that the magnetic field is generated by moving current. There's no electric current within the electron. So these are at the fundamental edge of reality is there. Now, what's happened is that in order to explain all this, I've sort of gone back and sort of looked and said, you need Schrodinger. So you've got Newton, you need Schrodinger. And then there's the development of Schrodinger where you add magnetic field phenomenologically and you get Pauli. And then you treat Schrodinger properly, or basically it's a differential equation. It's a simple equation saying that the formula for energy times an object equals that object. It transforms directly to a scalar, an integer, a number. A standard number. Your standard number 1 minus 1, 0 times that object. And that transformation, statement of the object defines that object. It's called an eigenvalue. So although Schrodinger is a breakthrough, the breakthrough is that rather than things being actual points, objects are actual solutions of their own physical state. I mean, it's something as profound as that if I've got a field, a 1.5 square coulombic field, and I put something which feels it, but a diffuse something, that something takes the shape and existence such that it makes energy sense. It solves for it. And so the actual thing is that it's not that we find solutions, that we find a solution for it. The actual thing is the solution. So this is that major, major step forward. So there are actually 8 levels of development. It's not 8 levels, 4 levels of development. And the 4th level is perhaps the working level. The previous levels are mezzanine levels. It's sort of like being a doctor going out to surgery. You can be a first year doctor, a second year doctor, third year doctor, but the fourth year doctor, you're allowed to do surgery. So similarly, the first year doctor, it is legitimate. It's a legitimate point in the training of it, but it's not sufficient to actually apply. You don't have sufficient knowledge of everything to actually apply it forward. So the first level is the Newton level, and the Newton level makes the assumption of, for this complicated extended object, I will contract it to a point. So for the Earth, we contract it to a point at the center of the Earth. For the Moon, we contract it to a point. For the Sun, we contract it to a point. And this obviously doesn't work, so we add some add-ons to it. Now, that's a mathematical thing, and it has the satisfying thing that it produces something simpler enough for a person to solve with a calculator. You can solve it with a calculator. The next level up is to say, we can't contract it to a point. These things have got an extension in space, like an Earth. If I go to a coordinate on it, I can pick up something, and I can pick up so much rock at so much point. Similar to an electron, I can say an electron is centered at this point, but if I can go up to this region, I can actually pick up a certain fraction of an electron out there. And that description of how much and where and when has to mean that, summed up over the equation, it all adds up. So I can take a little bit of point, and overall, when I add it all together, it all adds up. It's sort of like on Earth, your rock, if you hold up a rock, it will fall down, but after everything has fallen down, it's all held together. And so on a wave, this extended field of existence, an existence field, which is probably the wave function describes its functionality. That is, it is a shape which obeys it. It's not a descriptive wave. So let's see, we're going down 40 kilometers an hour again. It's got a functional, there's a functional description called wave function. Well, it's obviously, it's a wave and its function, it solves this equation. But there's actually a more physical description that you could have it, and that's, it's got an existence field. Now, the existence field is if I took a pole of it, at the point I could actually survey how much it existed at this point, which is probably an alternative way of saying it. Now, the important point at this point in time is that the separation between the functional description, which is a wave function, and the existence field is our first step into the unfamiliar. And it is unfamiliar because the wave, solution of the wave equation is, it's an algebraic solution. And algebra gives us more numbers than we actually can comprehend in reality. It has imaginary components to it. It is, involves the square root of things. And so the actual wave function is a second order wave function. So its solutions, being second order, squared second order, x squared is second order and the power of x, it has, the solutions are, has roots. Okay, so the solution of, you know, what number plus 5 will equal 10? Well, it's 5 plus 5. But what's the square root of 4? It's plus or minus 4. So you get these roots or multiple solutions, possible solutions for them. So this is important. So really, it's not completely everybody's fault, but it is, tends to be the fault of people having a limited way of describing this type of stuff. So you've got wave functions. Oh, it should be home. It should be all absolutely root and fine coming home here. So as I was saying, there's these four levels of description, and really the fourth level is your functional description that you really need to use in CERN, in computing, in so many things, probably three, but definitely third level, but fourth level is what you really need. Now the first level is, as I said, Newton, and that's where he contracts everything to a point, and this is really basically a teaching level. So we can see it's a teaching level. The next level is the Schrodinger level, which is the a differential equation, saying that the and its solution is not, well, it is correctly 3 and, well, it's hard to say. There's two levels of things that you find. There's two, you can't say. The equation has two variables, okay? The Schrodinger equation has two variables. Now, the first one is the first variable, okay? So, with two variables, it's a hunt around. The first variable is your energy not hot. Well, that's right. First variable is your scalar energy. You can select a variable. And the second variable, which you have to find, is the wave function. And the wave function is the wave answer, function answer. Okay, function is equation answer, solution, your wave solution. And what is that wave solution? A wave, you can then ask, what is the wave solution? The wave function is a existence field. What is a field? A field is a description of space, an audit of space, which ascribes a value to each point in space. So we exist in an atmospheric field. So in our atmosphere, every point in the atmosphere has a composition. That field has an existence field, which is the pressure. Or density here is the existence, and then there's these factors, that field factors that we can go through, like the temperature field, the motion field, and all that type of stuff. So basically, existence field, the electron is closer to being a donut. It has an existence field that, you know, if I take a bite away from the donut, I don't get anything. If I bite into the donut, I get into it because I'm biting into its existence field. So that's the second level up above Newton. And automatically you start to get into these things of wave functions. But you have to go a step further by saying, well, the solution, what is the solution if I add a magnetic field to it? And you get Pauli's spin tensor, and Pauli's spin tensor is people saying, well, what's the physical analogy of this? And already you're miles away from having a physical analogy that you can hang your hat on. This is spin up, spin down. He said it's hidden rotation dimensions, and people then start to come off with this single paper, which I'll have to try and track down who wrote it and why. Then after that, we say, well, rather than just a field with a energy equation with magnetic energy, why don't we just say a generic energy equation which is relativistic, which is, so it is true for all speeds. Not that it works for it works for particles travelling close to the speed of light. It works for all speeds, and this, so if Newton is zero, Schrodinger's got one wave function. Pauli's got two wave functions. Now, they're two wave functions, but you can... it's a two-rank matrix, or a two-rank spinor vector, a four-rank matrix, and you can rotate that such that's diagonalizable, and then you have one of one option and one of another. That's the best way I can describe it. But then you've got Dirac, who actually just physically solves, he basically has essentially a four-rank vector. And this is X, Y, Z, and time. That's space-time is four-time. And that gives you a phenomena called spin and the antiparticle. So you diagonalize it and you can have four possible electrons, which is a spin up, spin down, the antiparticle, the hole front, which then gives us the whole thing that going through the formalism, you get further and further from what we can understand. So in this idea, he has that in his formalism, you have negative energy, and so rather than zero being the lowest, you have minus infinity, the lowest. And so what he has is an infinite number of electrons. Space is full of an infinite number of negative electrons, which have completely filled the space. That's just where he gets it to. But look, the important point here is that there is a conceptual landscape out there without which you don't. It definitely does help to know all about it. And look, I admit I'm building the Einstein pendulum, and I struggle. And I read into this, and I struggle. Quantum field theory, I struggle with it. At least I know what it is. The difference is between myself and the teacher punter is that there's no sense that there's no comprehension of the significance of not understanding it. I think what you there is this false sense of security, and it was these people. I think they don't have this gradient of wanting to know more, that they know enough to teach and get their income and buy the groceries and build their reputation and stuff like that, but it doesn't really get you very much. Let's see where these guys are going. Yeah, so so I'm trying to write this paper, and there's this point that the whole issue is that there is actually there's not one community, there's actually two or more communities going on with different needs, yet they are overlapping the same place. There's a scientific community for which an incorrect explanation is handled in a different way. It is simply excluded or acknowledged or processed, whereas the population of incorrect explanations or population of solutions are available and can be used in a short term, in a limited way, to help people get places. So there's a legitimate use of incorrect explanations because they are the way people understand things. They toy for a little while, and there is a use of an incorrect explanation in as much that it's used to help illuminate and then orientate. And there's this two process thing going on. So let's just, as I'm coming up home, let's just reiterate what's going on here. You've got just trying to get my head around this. You've got Newton, which is point. Schrodinger wave, single wave function solution. Pauli, which is Schrodinger second order differential equation plus magnetic, which is a phenomenological one, two wave functions which are rotated, or you can solve, which is spin up, spin down, and a bit of a stab at the phenomenological, you know, is there actually a mechanism behind it, which is sort of the idea of, yet people still haven't really got up to the point that the people seeking a mechanism haven't actually addressed the actual point that the solution of a wave function is not a point. The solution of a wave function is a wave, or call a matter field or an existence field. I think matter field, perhaps existence field. Then you've got the fourth level, which happens to be, so the third level's got two, the second level's got one, the first level's got zero, so there's a set, but the fourth level's got four, which is spin up, spin down, and for the next thing, spin up, spin down, antimatter particle. Basically, antimatter particle is a whole, can be seen as a whole in existence, or it can be seen as an actual particle itself, or it can be seen, there's all these ways that antimatter is dealt with. So this is beyond the purview of it, but you need that overall perspective on it all. So look, this has been a rather complicated talk as I drive home, and the reason here is, one is that I'm slowly moving along from building a device to building a concept prototype, that is a concept prototype which actually gets the ideas and lays them out such that people can interact with them. That's what we're aiming for, the concept prototype. But then once we get there, part of the engineering is not just a physical engineering jump. Whoa. Gosh, there's this narrow bridge in this village of Glenbrook up top here, and a school bus which just would absolutely sweep up and kill everyone in front of it, but fortunately they know what's going on here. Okay, I'm home soon. Oh, it's going to be pandemonium. It's getting back to school time around around my home, and so it's unlikely to park. So look, there's two areas here, and it takes a while to actually build a prototype, and it takes a while to actually work into it that there's two greater dimensions. Oh, here, it's not so rough from here. There's two greater dimensions here. One is that there's more than one culture of understanding. There's the scientific culture, but there's the education culture. And then there's also a landscape of knowledge. And your perception of that landscape of knowledge is got to be more sophisticated. So I don't know how I can actually say that. It's okay to say that after how many of us 40 minutes of driving and talking, you can possibly say it. But how do you actually say that up front? How do you actually say, look, there's two cultures of understanding and a landscape of development of knowledge, and the way you navigate the landscape has to go into a new way of navigating the landscape. Okay, look, thanks a lot for that, and I'll continue off working and driving.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.